Good morning. It's really a privilege to be able to be here with you again this morning and share with you some of the things that God has been teaching me and speaking to me about in my life. I wanted to start by asking you guys a question of how many are, can you think of times in the Bible where the number seven occurs or comes up? Anybody? Things that you see done in the Bible in sevens. Creation. Good one. Anything else? The Sabbath. Absolutely. Anything else come to mind? What? 70 times 7. Jesus said to forgive 70 times 7. Actually, the number 7 is used over 700 times in the Bible. And the number itself is a sign of completeness or perfection. And bringing up creation, that is true. God created the world in 6 days, and it says on the seventh day, God rested. And I think that all of creation was actually created in that seventh day as well, and that rest, God created rest, and God wants us to rest. And so he actually set up a day of the week and said, on that last day of the week, I want you to take a rest. Now, for many of us, that doesn't always happen on the last day of the week. In the Old Testament and the way it was designed for the Israelites and the Jewish culture, it was the Sabbath was on Saturday. Saturday was the Sabbath, and it was the last day of the week. And on that day, God said, I want you to rest. I want you to take time to look at your life and rest. And take that time to reflect on your life and allow God to work in your life. When we take time out of our own lives and rest, what it requires of us is faith to believe that God will take care of whatever needs to be taken care of, and I can rest. And so that takes faith. And in our culture, that doesn't happen very often. But as I said, in the Old Testament, Sabbath was practiced diligently, and God said, I want you to rest on that seventh day. So what the Israelites did with that is they defined what work was, and they created 39 categories to define what work was. And you were not to do any of those things. You were supposed to rest. And if you broke any of the rules, then it could cost you your life. Some of the punishment, as I was reading through it, the punishment for breaking Sabbath was death in some cases, that you were to be put to death if you didn't rest. In looking at what Sabbath really is and what it is for our life, and why was it created? Was it created so that we would follow a bunch of rules in our life and rest? That's not what I believe. I believe that Jesus actually gave us the true definition of what the Sabbath was about. Because when Jesus came along, he ended up breaking Sabbath all the time. And the Pharisees followed him around wanting him to break the rules. It's kind of like, I want to catch him breaking the rules, because they wanted to kill him. And that is actually what he got accused of, and why partly why he was put to death. But Jesus, and so there was one instance in Mark, which is what I'm going to focus on, in Mark 2:27. Jesus had just been walking through the grain fields with his disciples, and they were hungry, and so they picked some wheat, and they were going to eat it. And the Pharisees were watching, and they're thinking, hey, aren't they breaking the rules, Jesus? They're not supposed to be doing that. Aren't they supposed to be keeping Sabbath? And Jesus' response to them was, he said this. He said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So when I think about the Sabbath and why God gave us the Sabbath, it's one of the Ten Commandments. Out of all the Ten Commandments, there are only two of the commandments where God actually told us to do something. One of them was to keep the Sabbath. Does anybody remember what the other one is? Honor your father and your mother. Those are the only two commandments out of the Ten Commandments where God actually told us to do something. The other eight tell us what not to do. So these are two things that we're supposed to be doing in our lives. We're supposed to be resting in our lives and taking time to reflect and look at our lives and see, where are you, God? What are you doing in my life? And when we do that, we begin to really walk by faith and not by sight, and allow God to show us and lead us. As I was doing this study on Sabbath and looking at all of this, I think that it was really clear that Jesus saw, when he said the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath, what he was saying is, I made this for you. I made the Sabbath for you. I want to give this to you as a gift. This is a gift. It's not a rule. It's not something that I think God is watching us and saying, you didn't do it, you broke it, and wanting to pounce on us. Jesus is saying, I'm doing this because you need this in your life. You need to rest. You need to have time to look at your life, to reflect on, and to see me. When you reflect on your life, you will see God in your life. And so it's God's gift to us. And we live in a world of frantic busyness and chronic distraction. And we live that way rather than living a life of restfulness and wonder. When we take the time to stop and rest, we see God. But people don't do that very often in our world anymore. We live in a world where if you have any downtime, you turn on your cell phone, or you play a game on your cell phone, or you talk to somebody, or you do something. And I see it everywhere I go now. It's like people don't want downtime in their life. We live in busyness. I read this story. It says in China, the polite answer to how are you is, I'm very busy, thank you. If you are very busy, then you must be very fine. If you have more to do and the list never gets done, but only longer, then you must be very fine. I found this to be true in our culture and in our country as well. In the last couple of months, I've had time to just travel around and observe and watch. And, I even went to the South. I had an opportunity to go on a trip to the South. And, the South is even considered a place where people are laid back and hanging out. They're more relaxed. And that can't be true, maybe, but they have cell phones too. And they're busy, busy, busy people as well. I think that for me, what I've been looking at my life and thinking, it's so easy to fill up our lives with activity and busyness and good things to do. And there's so many good things to do in this life. And it's really easy to stay really busy. I realize too, when I talk to people, when you ask people how you are, oh, I'm really busy. That's usually one of the first things you hear, is how busy people are. We're very, very busy people. And when we're too busy, we lose the ability to see God and to hear God. So over the last years of my life, God has been speaking to me a lot through the story of Joseph in the Bible. I love that story. It's one of my favorite stories in the Old Testament. And I just feel like I continue to glean more and more and more wisdom from the story of Joseph and his life. And Joseph's life, and I actually, a few years ago, this is in your bulletin as well, a few years ago when I was thinking about Joseph and reflecting on my life and reflecting on Joseph's life, I asked my son to paint me a picture and show the story of Joseph in a painting. And this is still, if you saw it up close, you would be able to see the detail. But he actually, that's why I had it printed, what this picture is about. I had it printed in the bulletin for you, because this is Joseph sitting in God's hand, reflecting back on his life and seeing the different benchmarks of his life and the ways that God was moving and working in his life. And you can't see it. Let's see, I think I have a little... this right up here, you can't see it, but there is, he does have a pit right there with the 11 sheaves, or the 10 sheaves, I guess it was, because it was his 10 brothers that he went out to see, and they threw him in a pit. If you know the story of Joseph, they took him, they were jealous of Joseph because Joseph was a braggart, and Joseph was the favorite son of his father. And so when he went out and saw his brothers out in the field, his dad sent him out there and said, go out and see how they're doing. So he went out and checked up on them, and he was the youngest at that time, went back and told his dad, gave him a bad report of his brothers. So it said then they hated him even more. They just hated his brother. They hated their brother, Joseph. So they threw him in this pit, and then they sold him into slavery. And off he went into Egypt. And God, he found, it said, it's interesting when I was reading this story again, because I read it again to speak to you, it said that Joseph was successful in everything that he did. He was successful, and yet he still was human like the rest of us, and he didn't do everything necessarily right. So Joseph goes to Egypt, and he ends up having the opportunity to go before Pharaoh and interpret dreams to Pharaoh. And he tells him that through Pharaoh's dreams, what God is saying is that there's going to be 7 years of abundance and then 7 years of famine in Egypt. And so Pharaoh puts him in charge of making sure that everything gets taken care of so that they'll be ready for the 7 years of famine. So the first 7 years of that, of those 14 years, I call the years of abundance in Joseph's life, getting ready for the years of famine. And it said that Joseph was very, very, very busy during those 7 years. He was busy. If you would have asked Joseph, you know, how are you today? He'd say, I'm very busy, thank you. Because he was going around to all the cities in Egypt and making sure that food was being collected and stored and being ready for that time of famine. During those years of abundance, he also had two children. And one of them, the second child, his name was Ephraim. And he was, it said, he gave him that name because it meant God had given him fruit in the place of his suffering. Because Joseph suffered a lot through all of these trials and tribulations of his life. And yet, he saw God giving to him even in the midst of his suffering. So, in those years of abundance, there was also a lot of suffering and stress and anxiety. And I began to look at this story of Joseph, and and I started reflecting on my own life. And so I've been looking back, and I want to take you back on a little journey with me through my own life and some of the things that God has taught me in the last 14 years. And so 14 years ago in 1998, I titled that, I said, that year started out with a bang for Bruce and I. That year literally started out with a bang. On New Year's Day, a man was shot at 27 times in our front yard and murdered. And so that was the way we started our new year. But because of that, it set in motion many, many, many things in our lives. And it one of the main things is it set in motion a move that we were going to make, that we were going to pick up where we were and move to another place, mainly because it was very traumatic. And I said, I don't think I can live here anymore and stay in this house where somebody was killed in my front yard. So God was gracious and we were able to sell our house. But during that time of my life, and some of you have heard some of these stories, but I have never really shared me personally. This happened to me and Bruce and my kids and everything, but this is my take on it. At that time also, I had two teenagers at home, a seven-year-old. I was going to school. We were involved in middle school ministry. We sold our house, and before we found another house to buy, we were homeless for two months and lived with relatives. We had to split up our family a bit. And still looking for a place, a house to buy. There just wasn't anything in our price range at that point. When God finally did pave the way and open the door for us to buy a house, we ended up buying a very old house that had been gutted. So it had no kitchen, no bathrooms finished. It had nothing. And so Bruce and I had been living away from our two older kids, were a block away from us at my sister's house, and we really, really wanted to come back together as a family. So Bruce and I worked day and night on that gutted house to get it functional so that we could move in and be together again. And we did that in 3 weeks, which was amazing, you know. But he was a builder, so he knew what he was doing, and I just helped. So we got that ready in 3 weeks, and that was the year of 1998 for us. In 1999, the property that we bought, and some of you have heard this, we ended up building a very large house in front of the little house that we bought. But in order to do that, we had to tear off part of the old house, which was Bruce and my bedroom. So now we were down, it was us and our three kids living in an even smaller house, and Bruce and I didn't have a bedroom. So our living room was our bedroom and our office. He had his own construction company. And it was our living room, our bedroom, and our office, all in one. And that was my life. And during that time, I was substitute teaching. I was studying for an extensive test that I had to take in order to get my emergency teaching credential so that I could teach full time. Bruce's parents had decided to move back to California to be with us, and so they came and moved in 1999, had nowhere to go. We had to find a place for them to live, which God provided again another kind of little hole-in-the-wall guest house that needed to be revamped. We did that. We started building our house, and in that year, we also found out that Bruce's sister, older sister, had cancer. That was 1999. In 2000, we moved into our new house. Now, I had been living in this one room that was my bedroom, my office, my living room, and it was kind of chaotic, you know, and so I was really excited to be moving into this new house that we had built. But the house wasn't finished in 2000. It was kind of like the shell was finished, but it didn't have a finished bathroom, and it didn't have a kitchen. And I didn't care. I just said, I'm moving in, because I just needed space. I wanted some space, and I didn't have it. And so we moved into that house, and the house that we had been living in was still on the same property, but it was behind the house that we moved into. So in order to cook or to go to the bathroom, you had to go out of one house and go into another house. And that was how we moved into our house. The day we moved in, Bruce's mom broke her back helping us move in. So we put her in the hospital and went through that. At that time, I had been hired as a full-time middle school teacher, so I was working full-time as a teacher. I still had all three kids at home. I started going to graduate school to get my teaching credential. Zachary, my oldest, the one that painted this painting, fell in love. He was a senior in high school, fell in love with his childhood sweetheart, I guess you could say, and told me when he was 17 that he was going to marry her. And I said, well, not anytime soon. And he married her the next year. So, that was also the year of Y2K. I don't know if you guys remember Y2K, but it was like the anxiety and the stress of what was going on in the nation is the whole economic collapse that we were going to come to as soon as those computers flipped over into 2000. That didn't happen. I remember that very well, because I was with Bruce and Marianne. I was like, hey, we're all still here. You know, the time passed by and we're all still here. Stressful year. These were the abundant years for us because we were building, we were creating. God, I was moving along in my career. They were abundant years. God was giving to us greatly. But there was also a lot of anxiety, a lot of stress. The people around me were, I had people around me all the time saying, how are you doing this? How are you coping with all of this? And I was like, with what? I'm fine. You know, this is just life. This is what you do. In 2001, Zach and Erica got married. They were, Zach was 19 and Erica was 18. And there was a lot of joy in that, and there was a lot of anxiety in that. Many, many people in the family didn't feel that they were old enough to get married. So it was kind of an anxious time for in that regard, too. And everybody thinking they're making a mistake, you're too young, all of these things. And also, Erica was a Hispanic girl. And we got to experience racism rearing its ugly head and with family members, and that caused a lot of stress in our lives as well. And so we got to go walk through that in 2001. I was still working full-time, still going to school, and still living in an unfinished house. In 2002, in June, right when I was giving finals to my students, I got a call while I was in school, and they said, you need to come to the hospital now. Your dad suffered cardiac arrest on the golf course, and they're bringing him to the hospital. I got to the hospital, and they said, you know, if he lives, he probably won't have any brain function, and he probably won't live through the night. And so I thought, my dad is dead. That's really what I thought at that moment. And he didn't die. For the next 5 weeks, my mother, my sister, and me, and the rest of my family, but you really hone in on the three of us, that family of origin, we were on an emotional roller coaster every day for 5 weeks. Because one day, he's doing better. The next day, I don't think he's going to make it. And so we'd have hope, and then we'd have our hopes dashed. And then we'd have hope, and then we'd have our hopes dashed. And that we did that for 5 solid weeks. During that time, my sister graduated from seminary, and it was joy and sorrow. We cried when she walked across the stage because my dad wasn't there to see it. He was laying in a hospital, and we had to run back over there as soon as her graduation was over. And my youngest, Marianne, graduated from elementary school and gave a speech, and she was very close to my dad, and he wasn't there to see it. So it was joyful and sorrowful at the same time. Now, during that year, I started to have some digestive problems. And like I said, my life was chaotic. It was really chaotic and really busy. And I just started feeling like I'd swallowed acid all the time, which was going on in my body. And so I went to a doctor. Everybody's like, Mom, you need to go. You know, my kids were always saying, Mom, you need to go to the doctor. And I don't really go to doctors much. But anyways, I did in that year. And they couldn't find anything wrong with me physically. And, you know, people were saying, maybe it's just stress. Maybe it's anxiety. You know, you're very busy. You're doing all these things. And it's like, I'm not anxious. I must have said I'm not anxious so many times through those years. I'm not anxious. I'm fine. And I think sometimes when you're in the middle of something, you can't see it. Other people can see it, but you can't see it. And that's kind of where I was at during those times. So anyways, I just carried on. And in 2003, we were living in the house. Bruce and I, at that time then, stepped into doing high school youth ministry at our church, kind of as an interim thing because the pastor had left. So we were very busy with that. We had kids in our house all the time. We were doing events. We had a very large house, which was nice. So we just had a lot of activity and a lot of things going on during that time of our life again. And I started getting very tired. In 2004, I like to call that year the year the wheels came off the bus. That was the year that in July 8th, we flew to Albuquerque and to take Bruce's parents to say goodbye to his sister who had been battling cancer since 99. And when we got there, we missed saying goodbye to her by a half an hour. And she died right when we landed on the runway. And so that was a very sorrowful time. And we walked through that with his parents and his older brother. And we came home. And she had 2 teenage daughters at the time, which we just felt grief-stricken for them. And we came home, and I know many of you know this story, but some of you don't. 3 weeks later, we got the call that Bruce's brother Brad had been killed in the line of duty here in Washington. And so we got on a plane the next day, and we flew to Washington. And we spent the next month walking through his death with his children, with his wife. And I started having crazy thoughts because Bruce just lost his sister 3 weeks before that. And then his older brother died. And I started thinking, are all the Crawford kids going to die? Is Bruce next? Yeah, I mean, it was crazy to even have that thought. But I had it. And it was just a very anxious-filled, stressful time of life. And also during, so, you know, Bruce didn't die, thankfully. We went home after that time of grieving, went back to California. I got a new job teaching at a school, a charter school called Options for Youth. And this school was a school for high-risk students and child actors, which they're kind of anxious too. But anyways, I started this new job, and there's a lot of stress when you start a new job as well, because I had to learn the whole job. And I have learned in the jobs that I have taken over my life that training is usually very, very minimal in jobs. They usually hand you the job and say, do it. So that's kind of what it was like for me in that job. And I was learning a new job. I was watching my husband grieve deeply for the loss of his sister and his brother. And that was 2004. It was an anxious-filled time. And again, I didn't see it. I just lived it. In 2005, I call that year High Anxiety, You Win. Because that was a movie, Mel Brooks' movie called High Anxiety. And it was a spoof on all of the Alfred Hitchcock movies. But he sang this song, and it was High Anxiety, You Win. And Bruce and I have just laughed and sung that to each other many times over the years. But in 2005, I think it did win in my life. And while I was teaching at that school, one day I was just coming down the stairs in the entryway of my house, and my parents had stopped by to say hello, and they walked in, and I just started feeling really sick. And I felt weird. I felt sick, and I didn't know what it was. And I said, I think I need you to take me to the hospital. And so we got in the car, we went to the hospital, and by the time we got to the hospital, I was sure that I was dying. I was sure that I was having a heart attack. And they hooked me up to all the monitors, they did all the tests, they did everything, and they said, no, it's just a panic attack. You're just having an anxiety attack. And it's like, but I'm not anxious. I don't understand that. How could I be having an anxiety? I don't have anxiety. I really, truly could not see that. And I couldn't see why I would. I was just living my life, doing these things. This is what life is. And so I got encouraged to go to another doctor, which, like I said, I don't do that well. So I did. I went to another doctor. He listened to me for 5 minutes. I'm serious. I think he listened to me for 5 minutes, describe a little bit of my life, and he said, oh, well, you have anxiety. That's your problem. You need to take this pill, you know. So that's what he did. He put me on medication and said, he said to me, you know, you probably could use some counseling too. And I thought, I don't need counseling. I'm fine. I didn't even believe him. When he said this little pill was going to take away all my physical symptoms, I thought, no, it's not. Because this is physical, what's going on. It's not anxiety. And so I started on this medication, and all my symptoms disappeared. I felt like when I was having those, I felt like I had a baseball in my chest. That's what it felt like. Just like I was living with a baseball in my chest. And so I started on anxiety medication, continued to live my life. And also during that time, it was in the spring of 2005, my daughter Emily, the one that was singing this morning, came home one day and said, you know, Mom, I think you and Dad are supposed to move to Washington, and I think I'm supposed to go with you. And I thought, as soon as she said it, I knew. It was like God speaking to me, saying, this is what you need to do. And that was the beginning of us moving to Washington that day. And that was 7 years. That was my 7 years of abundance. I was storing up and all of that. And God was good to us in that we were able to build a very large house and God gave to us a lot financially through the selling of that house to go into 7 years of famine. I didn't realize that's what was going to happen. That wasn't my plan, but that was God's plan. And so we moved to Washington, and I call those years the years of wonder and the years of famine. When Joseph went through those years, the years of famine, that was when God had him start looking at his life and looking back and seeing the brokenness of his family because of the famine. And also, just a little side note, when famine happens, people can't work because there's nothing to do, because nothing will grow. You know, the crops won't grow. There's not really anything you can do. It's kind of a forced rest. And so I saw that in Egypt that happened, but people were starving. And because of that famine, Joseph's family had to come to him in order to get food. They didn't know they were coming to Joseph, but they came. And because of them coming, God had Joseph look back at his life and deal with the stuff of his life before, all of the brokenness and the pain and the sorrow that he had experienced with his brothers way back when, came back when his brothers stood before him and asked for food. So he spent those years reflecting and looking back and suffering. I mean, he had to look at the pain of his life in order to be set free. And so for me, coming up here, Bruce and I, because I always have plans. I'm not one that isn't a planner. I plan my life pretty well. Well, I shouldn't say well, but I do plan. And so we came up here, and my plan was, okay, we're really tired. I mean, it has been a long haul, and we need to rest. And Bruce and I agreed, you know, we're going to take a year off. Bruce is going to write a book, and we're just going to let God come to us and rest. When we moved into the house we're living in, we didn't really like the way the house looked. We didn't like the colors on the walls. We just wanted to make it our own. And our furniture wasn't up in Washington yet. And we were laying on this mattress in our living room looking around and thinking, I don't even care. We'll just leave the colors on the wall. I don't even care. We just need to rest. And so we didn't do anything with the house. But, you know, to me, it's like take a year off and rest and get to know people, because I had no friends. I didn't know anybody in Washington except for family. And so that seemed reasonable to me, a year, because we could afford to do that. And so we did. And it was a good year. It was a year that I could completely rest and not worry, because I knew financially we were going to be okay, all those things. And I just began to wonder. And I started to wonder. I wonder what's going to happen to us next. And so 2007, I spent also wondering. I started asking the question, I wonder what I'm supposed to do with the rest of my life. After leaving, after all of the work and all of the stuff that I did to become a teacher, after I started teaching middle school, I knew that's not what I wanted to do. And so it's like, what am I supposed to do, God? What am I supposed to do with my life? And God led me, and so I started listening and just listening and being quiet and listening. And I feel like that God led me to a ministry called Spiritual Direction. And I started meeting, actually I went on a retreat and I met with some spiritual directors, and God provided a way for me to start to look at my life and understand my life. And so it was through that I was led to go to seminary. And when I started seminary, I asked God to transform my life. And he didn't disappoint. But the transformation, I thought, okay, this is the way I think, very categorically, I guess. I thought, I'm going to go to seminary. God's going to transform my life, and everything's going to be good. And that's not what happened. I went to seminary, and God started the transformation process in a much deeper way than I had ever experienced before. And I was asking, I wonder what God has for me in this environment. What am I going to learn? And I felt called at that point that God was calling me to a ministry of spiritual direction and to become a spiritual director. Now, it's just, you know, and people are still asking me the question, and I asked it all through seminary, what's the difference between a spiritual director and a therapist? And I was leaning on both directions. Should I become a therapist? Should I become a spiritual director? And God very clearly said, this is who you are, Kathy. This is who you are. Go this way, even though this feels safer to become a therapist. I knew this is where I was called to go. In my mind, just to clarify, therapy is the study of human behavior and personality, and therapy often treats mental disorders. Spiritual direction focuses on soul care and encountering God in the midst of your life, allowing your life to speak to you about who God is and who you are. So just to clarify that, because I get asked that all the time. One thing I'm truly thankful for with spiritual direction, I started meeting with a spiritual director in 2008 consistently and have met with one ever since. And what God did for me was he helped me face my fears and helped me see my life clearly. And one of the byproducts of that is that I didn't need to be on medication, which I didn't ever like being on medication, and I just didn't like it. So I thought, okay, if this is all anxiety, if this is my fear, God, help me face my fear, because I want to live like a free person. And so through the gift of spiritual direction in my life, God has set me free from that, which has been a good thing. I think that pastors and spiritual directors are one and the same. A pastor is a person with the gifts of discernment, wisdom, and the ability to listen well. And that's what a spiritual director is as well. And I know that God has called me to this ministry, and I am so thankful with what I have learned from having that experience, that is my deepest desire to give that to others. In 2009, I came to Cherry Grove, and at that time, I was exploring the possibility of using my gifts in different ways and becoming who it was that God really wanted me to be. And when I came here, you opened up your hearts, and you opened up the way for me to stand here and speak to you. And that has been a door that was closed to me for most of my life, especially in church. Because there are many, many, many churches that will not let a woman stand before you and speak. And so that has been a huge blessing in my life, and I thank you for it, because you guys have opened the door to me, and I'll forever be grateful. And I came from church. Another thing that drew me here that I loved about Quakerism and I loved about Cherry Grove was open worship, that we have times where we listen. We listen to God, and we let God speak to us and speak to us personally, to our lives. And I'd never really experienced that before I came here either. Church was always just busy, busy, busy program church, and everything's just going. And I was done with that. I was tired of it. I needed a place to rest, and this has been a good place for me to rest. And I had a lot of concerns standing up here. How are you guys going to receive me? How are you going to listen? How will you listen to me? Will it be favorable, or will you think, please sit down? And you guys have been very encouraging to me, and I want to thank you for that. Also, just God has brought many new friends and new faces into our lives, and I'm thankful for that. In 2010, I graduated from George Fox Evangelical Seminary, and I thought, well, so I wonder what's in store for me now. And I feel like I am embarking in a new way into a new phase of my life as a spiritual director and as a speaker. And I'm thankful that I have a place to do that. I've spent the last couple of years waiting and seeking and waiting and seeking and seeking to trust God. And I think about Joseph, and I think, you know, I think that dreams take a long time to be realized. And I've seen that and felt that in my own life, that dreams don't happen quickly. When you have big dreams for your life, they're going to happen over a whole lifetime. They're not going to happen like this. I've been told two things in my life by people. Well, I've been told a lot of things, but two that stand out. One was that I am an ambitious woman. And I thought, yes, and that led me down the road to a lot of high anxiety. The other one is that I'm an impatient woman. And I think God has sat me down for the last 7 years and say, can you wait? Can you listen? Can you wait? Can you listen? And I keep wanting to get up. It's like, okay, are we done? I thought it was going to be a year. It's been seven. It's been 7 years. There's been a lot of famine in our life in some ways, but there's been a lot of joy and a lot of goodness given to us as well. So I anticipate great new things for the future. So why do we need Sabbath again in our lives? I think we need Sabbath to remind us that God is God and we are not. And when we stop and we allow God to speak to us, in us and through us and through our lives, when we just slow down a bit, we can hear God. And I said, I mean, if we are so busy that we cannot stop our lives and listen to God, then we live like we are God. It is up to us to make things happen. And I thought, we have a saying for that, and you hear it all the time. God helps those who help themselves. And I don't think that's the way that we're called to live. I think that that's not living by faith. I would like to replace that little God helps those who help themselves with God helps those who surrender. God wants us to surrender our lives to Him. Sabbath transforms us by the renewing of our minds. We see through the lens of God's perspective. We live with a sense of wonder. Spending time with God refreshes the soul. We are filled with the Spirit. Proverbs 14:8 tells us that the wisdom of the wise is to give thought to their ways. They think about where they are going, but the folly of fools is deception. They keep lying to themselves. Wise people ask, does the path I'm walking lead to a place that I want to go? If I keep heading this way, will I like where I arrive? Fools don't ask that. They keep making excuses for themselves, justifying and blaming all the way to nowhere. They never change their minds. Busyness kills the heart. And I know for me, I could go there again if I let myself, if I don't pull back and say, God, I need you. God, I need you. And I need to be with you and I need to listen. And that, so I heard this, the paradox is if we don't listen, we never enter God's rest. Yet if we don't enter God's rest, we never listen. I think we all need to take time to listen to the Spirit of God that wants to speak to us, to listen to our lives and what God is saying in our lives. And I would even encourage to listen to the people in your lives, because it's not just anxiety. I've found so often, even sitting with people, and I'll say, do you think maybe you're angry? Oh, I'm not angry. You know, that's the first response. I'm not angry. Are you scared? I'm not scared. Are you, you know, people just automatically react to, I'm not that. And in reality, listen to the people that know you best, because they can see those things when you can't. And I know that from personal experience. And so I would like to pray and then just spend a few minutes before we leave and just listen. Let God speak to you. Let God speak through your life. So I'd like to pray. God, I thank you that you want to speak. You want to speak to each one of us and you want to share life with us, and you want to walk with us. Give us ears to hear you, God. Give us eyes to see you. I pray that for each person here, that even in this day, before this day is over, you will come to them and they will hear you, that they will stop and they will listen. And I pray now, even in these next few moments, God, as we sit and we listen together, that you will come, that your Spirit will speak. I thank you for your great love and your great compassion and your great mercy that you extend to each one of us as we come to you. Amen.